Hi there, and welcome back to another edition of Built to Sell Radio, the podcast designed to help you punch above your weight in a negotiation to sell your company. I'm the executive producer, Colin Morgan, and this week, we've got a two-for-one deal for you. Part one of this interview features John Rood, who built Next Step, a test prep business that helps students prepare for the MCATs. Now, John built Next Step to $10 million in revenue, with EBITDA margins ranging between 20 and 40% before selling to New Harbor Group, a private equity business, doing a roll-up of test prep companies. The exit left John Rood with his pockets full of cash, but feeling empty inside. He drifted and ended up having a difficult time processing his new life, which led him to consider if other founders struggled with life post-exit. He began interviewing other entrepreneurs who have sold and is now putting the finishing touches on a book called Beyond the Exit, which will come out later this year. You'll hear some of John's findings from his research with 71 exited founders during this wide-ranging interview. Without further ado, here is John Rood. Enjoy.
John Rood, welcome to Built to Sell Radio.
Hey, John. Thanks. Great to be here.
You were in the test prep business, and believe it or not, I've interviewed another guy in the test prep business. He was a former presidential candidate named Andrew Yang. Do you know Andrew?
No, I don't know Andrew. I know certainly who he is, and I know his story well. And we really built the company that I ended up building. We really modeled it after what his company had done, kind of like a boutique high-end model in a sort of in a different space in the test prep industry. But like, yeah, I mean, I saw what he did. He had a nice exit, and man, he's really, really made the best of it for sure.
He sure has. What a great story. So folks can listen to that, but we're here to talk about Next Step, which was your test prep business. Tell me what your unique take on this. Like, what was your unique take on the test prep? And for those of folks who don't know, maybe you could describe what test prep is as an industry.
Yeah, totally. So the test prep world is helping students do better on standardized tests. So the prototypical example is, you know, SAT or ACT, which is the college admissions test. You know, help high school kids do better on those tests, get into better colleges. There's all sorts of niches in that space. So, you know, any profession, you know, lawyers, doctors, et cetera, have their own tests to get into their own profession. So there's a bunch of little niches in that space. And what we started out doing was we thought that we would be in the law school space. And we ended up in the medical school admission space. After about 3 or 4 years of kind of fiddling around, not really knowing what we were doing, ended up in the med space, which worked well for us.
The medical space. So these are young people who want to get into med school.
Yep, correct.
And there are standardized tests to do that. What's the business model?
So there's a variety of business models in test prep. And it kind of starts from low price products all the way to high-end products. So the lower end of the spectrum is things like books, printed materials, flashcards, online quizzes. The next level up is courses. So in my day, which is now a little bit different, students would actually go to a testing center or a center on campus or off campus and actually sit in class. Now, of course, all that's online. And then at the highest end, there's all sorts of individualized tutoring services, which we did a lot of. There's, you know, multi-week boot camps to operate during the summer. So there's a range of offerings, and we at one point or another we did pretty much all of them.
Interesting. So you ran the gamut. If you could draw a pie chart, but kind of by the end, what are the big slices? You know, one-on-one tutoring, online learning. Like, what? How would you divvy up the pie?
Yeah, totally. So one-on-one tutoring was where we started. And everyone who works in test prep thinks that they can go start their own company, and lots of people try. And where everyone starts is individual tutoring, because it's pretty clear how to get started in that. So we actually built a pretty good niche in that. And by the end, we were probably 40% individual tutoring, and then 40% online content and resources, and then about 20% online courses.
What's the difference between content and resources and an online course?
So think of a course as you're going to go meet at a certain time with another group of people, whereas a resource would be, you know, the example that worked in our company is we did practice tests. So you log on, you take a practice version of the test that we taught for, and that was a really successful product for us.
It's interesting because I'd be curious to know how you kept tutors, because in the world that we all now live in, where Zoom and like online whiteboards and all that stuff exists, I would imagine most tutors worth their salt would rather just bill out for their time directly than to go through a test prep company. Did you have trouble to kind of keep and retain tutors?
You know, it's a really good question. And that's one of the problems that I stayed up at nights worrying about and then turned out to not be a problem whatsoever. We lost people over the years sometimes for exactly that reason, because you see, the company's billing me out for twice what I earn. And that's why people go start their own test prep companies. And then like I'd said, but what we found was a couple things. So number one was obviously getting the students. So a large company with national reputation and natural reach that has professional marketing will get a lot more students than someone that is just like posting up, you know, flyers around campus. Secondly, us being able to kind of be a layer of intermediary between the teacher and the student, and often the parent, who's the kind of the fourth party there. I think that most of our instructors found that to be pretty valuable.
He's smiling as he describes the parent interface. Yeah. Why isn't my kid getting 1400?
Exactly.
Promise me they get 1400.
It's like, not easy.
You lead a horse to water. Oh, I can only imagine. How did you guys finance this thing? I mean, did you own 100%? Did you raise money? Did you have partners? Like, what was that like?
This was bootstrapped. So I had spent 3 years at the beginning of my career in management consulting, and I think I earned $50,000, and I think I got a promotion to $60,000 and lived real cheap. And then by the end of those 3 years, I mean, it wasn't a lot of money, but it was enough to kind of pay our expenses for a little while as the company got going.
And then you kind of poured. Were you pouring profit back in to build up, or were you drawing a lot of cash out as you grew, or what was that like?
We were drawing a lot of cash, and I think that's probably, if I had to do it again, I would probably keep more money in the business, which I think is like atypical. Like, I think that most entrepreneurs probably overinvest in their business at the expense of kind of their, you know, their own personal savings. But I don't know. Like, I was always really frugal. I was really excited to be earning money. You know, like I said, I wasn't earning a ton of money before. So when I had the opportunity to earn like $100,000 a year, like, oh my God, like that's a huge amount of money. And then like, as it kind of ramps up, like that kept being the case. So I think we kind of underinvested in it. Probably could have been bigger than we made it by the end had I kept more of that money in there. But just like, who I am and was, the way that I was raised, like if there's an opportunity to put some money in the bank in a safe way, like that was really important to me.
And were you building to sell? I mean, were you planning an exit, or was this sort of like, you know, a business you were planning to pass on to your kids, or what was your end game?
I think that we had always intended to sell it at some point. And
sorry,
I think
that's
me and my wife, who actually worked together on the business. She ended up going to law school and having her own law firm and doing some other stuff, but we worked on it together in the beginning. And she was always a board member and a presence in the business. So I think the business was built to sell. It's funny. I don't think I ever considered for a second that my kids would want to run it, in part because I started it when I was 26. We didn't have any kids, but I never really thought about that at all. I thought this was kind of the vehicle that I have to make money, to build wealth in my life. And that was what it was there for.
Got it. And what did you do? We were talking before we hit record about some of the moves you made to kind of jack up the value of the business, because a service business generally trades at a fairly modest multiple of earnings with a lot of the kind of cash tied to an earnout. But you did some things. Maybe walk through what you did to build more value into the company.
Yeah, totally. So our story was, we started doing individual tutoring in this education niche that we were in, and that market was a good market. You know, I think we did really well there. But has a bunch of problems. One of them being the one that you had mentioned before, which is sometimes the tutors want to leave. And so there's a question of like, if you buy the business, what are you actually buying, right? Like if you're just buying a list of instructors and some marketing resources, that's worth something, but it's not worth, you know, an attractive multiple. So as we kind of got the business to be more mature, we saw, you know, we really need to get more into the content space. So we started writing books. We eventually published 8 print publications, which was a heck of a lot of work that did okay. And then we did a number of practice exams and practice resources online for our students and sold those separately. Those did very well. And in the education world, at least, I'm sure it's similar in other industries, but in education, kind of like the bottom value is services. The next value up is you know, content, professional development for teachers, video lectures, et cetera. And then as you get higher, right, the next thing is, can you deliver that in a systemic way, oftentimes on a subscription basis with technology? So we started to think about, you know, we've got these good resources. We need to start building out our technology that's going to be able to kind of bring those to students and make it look more like a subscription-based company, more as opposed to a, you know, exchanging time for money type company.
And were you able to design a subscription model? I'm thinking an MCAT. Like once you pass, you're kind of done.
Yeah.
How did you do on a subscription model?
Yeah. So it, generically in education, things are sold kind of in blocks of time. And that's basically what we did. And for exactly the reason that you said, right? So a student will say, hey, I'm taking this exam in 3 months, 6 months, 9 months, 12 months, whatever. You buy that block of time, then you have it. And then of course, one of the biggest problems in the test prep world is 100% of your students churn. And if your students don't churn, it's because something got messed up, right? If they have to take the test again, right? That's an even bigger problem. So, you know, that's one of the challenges. But being able to kind of make sure that you've got a products that kind of fit those blocks of time it was really critical.
And did you ever think about selling something to the universities themselves, the med schools that were trying to recruit students? Did you ever get any revenue from the schools themselves?
Not really. I mean, we poked around at that a little bit. It just wasn't a big market.
How big did you get this company in terms of whatever you're comfortable sharing, revenue or number of employees before you decided to exit?
So it was high single digits, millions of revenue. So I was between $5 and $10 million in revenue. And I think we had 21 full-time employees and about 150 instructors.
Got it. And profitable, like EBITDA margins good? Can you give us a range of margin as to what you put to the bottom line on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think it would depend on the year, but we'd be somewhere between probably 20 and 40% on a given year. So that's a good business. It's really hard to get to that point, but when things kind of got humming, it went pretty well.
What was the hardest part?
I would say the hardest part is market differentiation in this space. So we're competing against really large companies that have been doing test prep for now 100 years. Kaplan is the number one name in test prep, and they've got a presence in every different market. So competing against the companies that really have all those advantages of longevity and just mind share of students is really hard. And it's kind of one of those markets, I think, where given that that's the case, like your product can't be 2% better or 5% better or 10% better. It's got to be 50% better. It's got to be like noticeably better in order to win.
And so your product presumably was better.
I think so. Yeah, that's my opinion. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, better be if you're right. The founder. So what else did you do to differentiate the company beyond the product itself? I understand the product was better, but what else did you do to compete against Kaplan, which is this kind of 800-pound gorilla?
You know, I what I found was that the team that we ended up building by the end felt to me just like an all-star team. I mean, we had people that had been at Kaplan or at, you know, one of our other competitors for, in some cases, over a decade that came to play on our team because they liked the culture, they liked the product, they liked what we were building. I think that, you know, a company of that stage, it's on a great growth trajectory and has a great growth story, has a lot of advantages in recruiting for, you know, really for those reasons. Like, everyone wants to be a part of the winning team. And if we're able to show people that vision and say like, hey, we're building something big and exciting here, we're doing it with an all-star team, we tended to kind of like roll that boulder downhill as opposed to uphill for recruiting.
Well, with 20 employees and almost $10 million in revenue, you're basically $500,000 per employee, which is a pretty big number.
That's a big number. And we did have, you know, all of our instructors that got a cut of that too. So it gets distributed over more people, a lot of them are part-time.
Oh, right. I forgot. You've got not only full-time, but you've also got part-time,
yeah,
and tutors and so forth. Did you have any sense of what it might be worth before you went to market, before, like, had you kind of done any market sense of it's a 5x EBITDA or a 10x EBITDA? Like, did you have any sense of what you thought the market was for a company like yours?
I had a little bit of an inkling, just because the space that we're in is really small, right? There's just not a lot of companies that kind of get to that, even a relatively modest size of being in the millions of dollars of revenue. So when a deal would get announced, like, you kind of hear about it and kind of like, you know, call your friends and see what these things might be worth. But I don't think I really had a really good idea. And certainly there was nothing that said like, we never got a valuation or anything like that said like, here's what we think it's worth before we started to get actual market signals.
Yeah. Yeah. But when you looked around at other deals being done, you talked to friends, like, what were people saying? What kind of ranges were you hearing?
We were hearing people that were selling for, I mean, we saw a lot that were kind of in the, like, that kind of the services type bucket that were selling for 2x to 4x earnings. Much larger than that, I think was pretty unusual until you got to like the really large companies, who are, you know, getting bought by Publix or getting bought by, you know, already fairly large companies that were trading for much higher. Oftentimes with really big kind of like technology angles, who were selling to clients like universities that you had mentioned in sort of like adjacent industries. So like things like student services, things like managing financial aid, in the education world, which were, you know, education, but were significantly different businesses.
Got it. Yeah, that makes sense. And so tell me about the exit. Like, was there something that triggered this, or like what happened?
Yeah, I had been in that business for 8 years and it felt like a long time. I was still having fun with it. I think, you know, as I mentioned, I love that team and everyone that was on it. We started to see that, I think, to kind of take the next step, it was going to take a big reinvestment. And it actually kind of goes to the question that you had asked about whether we took money out of the business or whether we reinvested. And I had felt to really get to the next step, we needed a big push on technology. We needed a big push on people. And the earnings that we had were needed to get plowed back into that business for several years. And then if something happened, there was a significant risk, at least in my mind, that we would be left with virtually zero, right? I mean, we had a quite profitable company. If we, you know, plowed a bunch of money back into it and then one of 100 different things went wrong, and now we've got a company that is either, you know, barely profitable or losing money or something, that's just not worth very much in our industry at all. So, like many entrepreneurs, it was just kind of time to de-risk it a little bit and get something off the table.
Yeah. And I'd be curious, like, was, you know, a lot of times I hear like it's the birth of a child. I think there's something about having a kid where like that protector sort of gene or you know, side of your personality kicks in and you're like, man, I've got to provide for this, you know, this little human being that's totally defenseless. Was there any sort of life event that you could point to in your own life that triggered?
That's a good question. And it was, we sold in 18, really decided to sell in 17, at the end of 17. So my first son was born in 2015, my second son in 2017. So it was around that time. I do think that my hope was to be able to make sure that I was around for my kids growing up. And when we talk about kind of like what life is like now, like that's a big part of it. But I really didn't want to kind of miss out on that. I didn't want to have to be at work 80 hours a week during those first few years of my kids' lives.
Yeah. Okay. Got it. So brand new kids, been 8 years. You think, you know, maybe now's the time to de-risk a little. So what did you do next?
So we had started getting outreach from a number of buyers, which I think now like everyone gets outreach like every week from someone. But we just started to get a little bit of push from kind of the search fund crowd in, you know, say 2016, 2017. And I had an advisor and board member who was in a kind of like a big time consulting organization, just kind of knew all the players in the Chicago area, went to Chicago booth for business school. So just knew everybody and said one day, like, you know, we should take you around and introduce you to some of the private equity guys. So he took me around, introduced me to a bunch of the private equity guys. We had a lot of nice conversations. And then, you know, ultimately, this was years later, a couple of years later, we ended up selling to one of those people that we had met kind of during that tour, that was putting together a roll up in that space.
And when you did those, so the kind of the tour a couple of years prior, like how would you, for folks who are maybe thinking of doing something similar, some very kind of passive outreach, entertaining a couple of conversations, like what did you learn about those conversations? What was surprising or what did you find? Again, this is a couple of years before they got serious. Yeah. So how would you characterize those conversations?
Well, they weren't particularly hard to get because I think that folks in the, you know, in the investment space, in the private equity space, in the M&A space always want to learn. So when you set one of those meetings, they come with a list of questions because they want to learn about your business. And part of that is to your benefit, right? Because you want to kind of be spreading the word about what you're doing. Hey, this is a great company and we're growing, et cetera. But at the same time, like they want to know who are your competitors? How big are your competitors? This is a good space generally. So if you're kind of hitting the right type of firm or the right strategic buyer that's interested in your space, they really want to know, they want to know all about it. On the flip side, I think we learned a ton. Number one, I don't think I knew how, you know, private equity worked. I don't think I knew how strategic acquisitions really worked. And I could have learned in a better way. Like I could have like picked up a book and I don't know why I didn't, but I just didn't. So I think learning how that process works a little bit was beneficial. I think the other part of it was, you know, we had one meeting with a really big firm, not the people that ended up buying us, but you know, we went in there and they were like, how big is your company? And so I told them, they're like, okay, that's too small. And like, that was like a 10 minute meeting. But what's beneficial about that was to kind of learn, like, what are the yardsticks where you can really be a successful acquisition for different sizes of companies, right? So if you've got a company with $500,000 in earnings, there's a search fund type person out there, you know, who would love to buy your company, I'm sure. But, you know, if you really want to get into institutional capital, be bought by a significant firm, you know, you've got to be thinking about getting into kind of millions of dollars of earnings. And so that lets you think about where are we now? Where do we have to kind of get to before this is a realistic option?
Got it. And I would point my listeners to a couple of episodes we've done in the past. Steve Davidikos, we had a couple of weeks ago, who talked about the search fund that John is referring to now. So check that episode out. Adam Coffey talked about the private equity playbook. So talks a lot about the sort of tranches of size. So a couple of resources for my listeners to check out to go deeper where you're referring. But this makes a ton of sense. So you have these conversations. How did you handle direct questions like, what's your profit? What's your revenue? What makes you unique? I mean, were you totally an open book? Did you hold some stuff back?
That's a good question. And it's funny, it feels so long ago. I'm trying to remember these conversations exactly. My perspective is generally to be honest with people. I think probably you would say a range, like what's your revenue? I'd say, oh, between X and Y. Why did I do that? I don't know. Like, it probably feels like you're not supposed to tell people who are more sophisticated investors than you, like all of your information. But eventually it's going to come to light. And so I feel generally like it's better for people to be honest. And, you know, putting myself back in those shoes, like when I learned, like, what's the exact revenue of one of my competitors? Like, what do I do with that information? That doesn't help me compete against them more efficiently. It's just like, kind of like a nice to know. So I think I was pretty honest and probably would be even more honest in the future.
Got it. Okay. So phase one, you have these kind of very polite, very nice, superficial meetings around town with private equity groups. Where does it go from there?
So then nothing happened for a while. So we went and built our business. And then, you know, one day one of those folks called up and said, you know, hey, we're putting together a, you know, a roll up in this space and looking at a, you know, another company that we would want to put you with. you know, do you want to talk about it? So we had those conversations, and those went well. And, you know, that process just went forward over the course of a couple months. And then ultimately, it came time for us to decide, and we decided. And I think it was a good group of investors. You know, we're still engaged with them now. I'm still on the board over there. It was good folks working on the roll up in the other business. So it felt like a good fit. It felt like a group that could kind of meet that goal that I had for the business of reinvesting in the technology. So that I think was part of it. And that ultimately, I think, did come to pass and what happened with the company. And so those were kind of our drivers.
Got it. What was your reaction to their, I'm assuming at some point they provided you with an LOI, a letter of intent, which was like the document before the share purchase agreement, but the sort of informal, what was your reaction to that?
I thought it was amazing. I thought we had started to get an idea of kind of what the valuation should have been like. And I think it's hard because especially as a first-time entrepreneur, as someone who didn't come from a wealthy family, who didn't have a lot of personal savings or wealth, seeing what the number is, like there's kind of two senses of it, right? So one sense is, oh my God, this is a huge amount of money and it's going to change my life. And there's the second sense of it, which is like, wait a second. I'm like a very sophisticated business person. We're going to have to negotiate this and like really ratchet it up. But it's like on one side, you're like, well, this is not enough money. And that's like the public face. And like the private face is like Scrooge McDuck, like bathing in money. Right. And it's kind of like managing those two sides of your personality, or at least my personality in that process.
Did you pull it off? I mean, did you kind of fold your arms and they first sent it and said, this isn't enough? Like, what was your physical reaction?
I think I did okay with it. I think we got to where everyone was happy with it. I think it was good.
Yeah. Got it. And did you go to market? I mean, you went to a few firms 2 years prior. Did you sort of feel out if there were others that might be interested or?
Yeah. Yeah, we did. So we hired a banker who kind of run like a closed process for us, I think you would say, where he just went out to like a short list of maybe a dozen folks and saw who else was interested. And we got some other valuations from some other groups, including a strategic. And those were all fine. But I think that the original offer was pretty close to where we had needed to be.
Yeah. And I know we have to be careful about what the actual numbers were, and I totally respect that. And you can just tell me to go to hell if you want. but I'd be curious, you know, when you first started to kind of hear about other deals, you'd sort of heard 2 to 4 times EBITDA, heavy service base was sort of, I'm going to read between the lines and say, it may have exceeded that if you were kind of eye popping and thinking, this is awesome. Your impression of the number was probably like, hey, this is better than what I've heard the market will bear. Confirm or deny? Or
yeah, I think that's relatively true. I think that we were successful at a business in escaping kind of the service business trap.
Yeah, yeah. And how did you structure the deal? Most of these private equity deals, and again, I encourage our listeners to go check out Adam Coffey if folks are listening, but there's usually sort of an equity role that, mm-hmm. that they ask the founder to do, to make. Did yours structure it that way where there was a kind of majority recapitalization, but then there was an equity role?
Yeah, that's correct. That's what we did.
Got it. And then what about operating the business post-sale? Did they ask you to stay on and sort of run it, or what was that like?
Yeah, so we stayed on. Everyone on the management team, I think, was supposed to stay. I personally ended up as COO of the combined business, and I stayed there for 2 years operating that business.
Who was the CEO?
The founder of the other company that they put us with.
Ooh, that's okay. So that's got to be interesting dynamics. I mean, two entrepreneurs, that can be very challenging. What was that like to have another entrepreneur who had probably a very similar background sort of be your boss?
I have nothing but good things to say about everyone involved. And I will say from my own, because ultimately, what do we control? We don't control our environment. We don't control, you know, what other people do. We control our own actions and our own responses to things. I think it was very difficult for me. And looking back at that, And again, like I don't think anyone did anything wrong, like really including me. But I think for your reaction is exactly right. You're like, oh my God, that's a hard reaction. Yeah, it's hard. And I think that, you know, for me, and I believe for a lot of entrepreneurs, but speaking for me, like, you know, I got into this because I didn't really want to have a boss. Like I didn't, when I was, you know, I worked in consulting for 3 years. I thought my bosses there were great too, but didn't really love having one. And so I think that, you know, yeah, selling and kind of moving into a position where you're not in charge is hard. But I think like whatever your title or position in the business is, it always changes when you sell it. Like you're not the majority owner. So if you're the CEO or you get bumped down to marketing associate, it kind of doesn't matter because the CEO still reports to the investors, reports to the board, et cetera. So I think that just the process of going from closely held, you know, majority owner of a business to not is a big adjustment for sure.
Yeah, because not only is it you know, you're used to being in complete control, you bootstrapped it, you're the final decision maker on everything. Now you've got this sort of boss. But what I find fascinating is not only do you have a boss, but a chunk of your wealth is in this company that you're relying on your boss to execute effectively. And there must be times along the way where you disagree and you're like, I disagree. And not only am I pissed off at my boss, but this huge chunk of money is at risk. That must be brutal.
Yeah, I think that is both hard and common for folks that sell. I think like, You know, speaking for myself, I think it's exactly right. Like we, you know, there's a significant amount that you roll over in a deal like this and you feel pretty, you know, forcefully that you want that to do well. And having multiple kind of strong viewed successful people having different opinions causes conflict. And then the question is like, what do you do with that conflict? How do you manage it? Those are the questions. And I, you know, now looking back at that in hindsight, like I probably could have managed some of that better for myself, you know, again, with my own actions, my own reactions, my own emotions. But I think it's generically a challenging time.
Yeah, for sure. No question. And we've heard that from others. How did you structure, like, was there a straw that broke the camel's back that you decided to leave? Or was it a period of time? Like how and when did you decide to leave an operating role?
Yeah, so I left after about 2 years. There was no structure to it that dictated that. It just felt like it was time to move on. Like I, you know, at that point I'd been with this business for 10 years. It was changing. I didn't think that my skill set was as necessary as it had been before. And there was just other things that I wanted to do with my time and with my life. You know, we're kind of foreshadowing to the other part of our conversation here a little bit, but like, I'm not sure what those, I don't think I'd thought hard enough about what those things were going to be, but I knew for sure that, you know, this is a business I started when I was, you know, 26 or 27. I didn't want to be doing it when I was 67. And there just the time was just right.
Yeah. And so you remain on as a board member and significant shareholder
Correct.
Of the company. And that's helpful. And I've never had that role. So this is somewhat for my own edification, but you now would vote on key decisions, you'd vote on a budget, and presumably, and you would have sort of one vote and there'd be other board members that could outweigh you, presumably from the private equity group. If there was a contentious decision, you would have sort of one vote, but there would be others that would sort of drown you out if everybody kind of lined up against you on a certain vote. Is that how that works?
Yeah. What you said from a sort of a technical legal standpoint, what you said is absolutely correct. What I've observed on the board that I'm on, as well as a bunch of the other advisory and board roles that I've been on for other companies, is no one wants those things to come down to a vote. So, you know, when you read in the news about like, Sam Altman gets fired from OpenAI and the vote was 3-2 or whatever, like that's not how these kinds of things operate. Because to your point, the majority investor has infinity votes, right? And if it comes down to it, someone has infinity votes and you have like one, right? So no one wants it to get to that point. So you're there to advise, you're there to instruct, you're there to kind of impart whatever sort of experiences you can from, you know, from running your company in ancient history, plus whatever you're doing now. And it's, I think, ideally a very advisory and collaborative process, and not a three votes to two type process.
Yeah. That's really helpful for me and having never kind of done that before. It's interesting. And it does provide a kind of a closure point for our conversation about your exit. But as you alluded to, there's a second part of our conversation that I wanted to have, because you've just done an amazing piece of research with 71 exited founders, and you're working some of that research into a book. So maybe let's talk about the book. It's called Beyond the Exit. What inspired you to kind of want to write it?
Yeah, thanks for asking. So it's a couple of things. The selfish reason was I always wanted to write a book. Since I've been little, like that's a goal of mine, to have a piece of work that, you know, I don't fool myself that people will be reading this in 500 years, but that, you know, that will exist after I'm done. It's a thing I knew a lot about, and it's a process where this kind of post-exit time, like the time for, you know, for myself after I sold and after I left the operating company, I just didn't think hard enough about what I wanted to do with that time or how I wanted it to work. And it was just a really kind of lost in the woods time for me. Like I you know, had depression from that time. I didn't know what I should work on. You know, I was like, try to do one thing and then like hate that and quit, and try to do another thing and hate that and quit. And it just wasn't a good time for me. And I don't know why I hadn't done this before, but I started then ask, you know, entrepreneurs who were kind of like ahead of me on the journey, like, well, wait a second, like if you sold a business 10 years ago, 20 years ago, what was that time like? They're like, oh, and they described all those things, right? So I realized that it's not that I was just like, that I was doing it wrong. I can do it, but I could have done it better, but I wasn't doing it wrong. It's just a life stage, right? But it's a life stage that no one talks about, right? For a couple of reasons. Number one, not many people like have gone through it. So it's like the people that have been on your podcast, and that's sort of that's kind of it, right? There's a couple thousand people that sell a significant business every year. And so that's a small group. And people also just like, honestly, like don't like hearing about the problems of rich whiners, which is a quote that I heard from in one of my interviews, right? And, you know, I try to be explicit about that. Like the problems that I have, like, what do I want to do with my life? Like, that's extremely important to me, like in the context of like war in the Middle East and, you know, starving children and political turmoil and whatever. Like my problems don't matter. Like I'm fine. My kids are fine. Like my life is great. But that said, it's an important part of people's lives, and I would love for people to kind of go through it, kind of knowing better what to expect and hopefully handling it ultimately better than I did.
And to be clear, when you're describing this period of sense of loss and being a little bit lost in the woods, I think is the expression you use. This is after you have stepped down as chief operating officer of the combined businesses.
Correct.
Correct.
Yeah.
Okay. So you're you've gone through an exit, you did a majority recapitalization, you're COO, and this is when you've left. So you really are, you've got time on your hands now, which is the big factor,
right?
X factor, where you've got time to contemplate and you felt fairly lost. Yeah. What was it like with your wife? You mentioned your wife and she's building a law firm. I found sometimes it can be really hard on a spousal relationship, like a married couple.
Yeah.
I'd just be curious for you, if you're willing to share what that was like for your relationship.
Yeah, I think it was a hard transition. I mean, I think that people sometimes say, I'm not sure if I agree with this, but people say that the definition of stress is change. And there's a lot of change when you sell a business and go from, you know, doing one thing to not knowing what you are going to do, from, you know, oftentimes going to an office every day for 10 hours to like piddling around the house at 3 p.m. like all day. And I think that that's a period of change. I think that, you know, for us, there had been a lot of focus on this business, right? And for whatever that's worth, like the focus in an entrepreneurial family is oftentimes on the business, right? Sometimes at the expense of other things that are going on. And so, you know, I think for us, it was figuring out how to move that focus away from the business, which no longer exists, but like we don't have any control of it, to kind of like the rest of life. And, you know, saying that, as I worked through all these interviews and started crafting them into this book, that was surprisingly common. And, you know, we heard a lot of people who would go through hard times in their marriage. Oftentimes people would get divorced during this period. And it was such a surprise. And it's one of those things like, why am I writing the book? I want to inform people of that, right? Because sometimes I think, you know, if I look back 10 years in my own life and say, wait a second, what if I sell my business for a huge amount of money? Like, won't that be incredible? Like, well, then like my life will be perfect. I interviewed a guy who I always use this quote. He's an amazing guy. And he said, my life after exiting my business was 10 out of 10, but I thought it would be 14 out of 10. And when you think about, you know, your relationships, like you think, okay, it's going to be like this golden period and we're going to like go on all these Caribbean vacations or whatever. And then the reality is like, it's a change that has to kind of be worked through the system, not only of the individual, but of the family.
That's really interesting. What else? I'd be curious to know what other themes came out of these 71 interviews. Like what, I know you've written a whole book about it. So yeah. I'm curious to know two or three that really popped for you.
Yeah. So one of them, and the biggest piece of advice I think that comes out of the work is that people need to be thinking about what they want to do after they leave their business, before they leave their business. And I was just terrible at this. Like I have no excuse for why. I never really sat down and said like, here's what I want the next 5 years or 10 years to be like. And, you know, you and I have talked about, you know, I've been a member of EO and, you know, so have you. And we do like all sorts of like life planning and goal setting and everything in you know, in place like EO. I just didn't do that, right? I just didn't sit down and say like, here's what I want to do after I leave this business. And the people that had an easier transition out of their business had something that they were exiting to. And it couldn't just be golf, right? It couldn't just be like, I'm going to work less and like watch more movies. It had to be like a thing that was going to like take their energies, their creativity, like their drive and point it in a different direction. And, you know, the people like me that hadn't thought about that weren't as successful. So I think that was one really, really big theme. I think a second is that this period lasts longer than a lot of people think. And I think that there's a period of mourning, which can be delayed, but not avoided. And what I mean by that is some of the people that I interviewed would exit the business. I interviewed one guy who sold his business. He was very public with his numbers it's like $780 million, right? And wow. He had partners, investors, but like he was set for life. But he was like, you know, like, hey, I was an immigrant. I've experienced like poverty. I've experienced homelessness, et cetera. And it's just not in my DNA to chill. So we like started another business like the week after he got out of the first one. And what I learned was that people that do that generally end up hating the new thing that they get into. They want to, and they like feel trapped. They want to get out of that because they got in it for the wrong reasons. They got in it because like they have to kind of keep paddling. And the people that were more successful said, wait a second, like this is a time of grieving. This is a time of transition. I'm going to step back. And I'm going to do a process of kind of working through this time before I jump into something else.
Did you ever ask as part of your interviews, would they do it again?
If start a company?
Yeah. No, sell a company.
Yeah, that's interesting. That's a really good question. I had a couple of people that had very specific reasons for regretting selling. And I think part of it is that grieving process. Everyone needs to work out their regret about something that happened in their deal, right? So what could it be, right? So I interviewed one guy who was like, well, the guys that bought my company screwed me in like XYZ way. I've got other people that said they bought my company, then fired all my good people. And I think about that every night, right? I heard that actually multiple times. One of them, which I it's funny, I didn't hear this as much because assets have been priced so high, like almost no one regretted selling for the amount they regret. Like almost no one in this group was like, oh my God, my life would have been better had I only had $500,000 more, right? Like no one thinks about that at that level anymore. But yeah, I mean, one of the really interesting kind of lines of thought is the people that had had inherited the business that they ran. It was a family business. And I remember one guy who said, he's really honest about this. He was like, my dad gave me a thing and I don't have that thing to give to my children. And I was like, well, but you can give them like the money that you got for it. And that's pretty good. He's like, nope. Like this thing was like he saw it like a watch you get from your grandfather, right? Like I was given a thing, it's a family heirloom and I sold it for money. Like I just like took my watch to the pawn shop almost. And that really like that, like those things I think can hit really hard.
Wow. Yeah. I hadn't even thought of that, but you're right. You're given a family heirloom and you think about the watch is a perfect analogy, right? You get this Philip Patak beautiful watch that was your grandfather to pass it down. Then you're like, I'm selling it for the highest bidder. Like you can feel kind of like a money grubbing soulless, you know, I'm not suggesting that's what that individual is or was, but I'm certain those feelings at times pop up.
It's a thing to work through.
Yeah. It does sound like a grieving process as you describe, for sure. What about, did you hear anything around personal finances? So, you know, common questions like, what'd you do with the money? Or, you know, like, did you hear anything around lessons learned around what to do with all this money once you accumulate it?
Yeah, we talked a ton about that. And there's a ton about that in the book. One of the first things that people learn, and it's one of those things like, I'm going to say it to you, you'll be like, well, that's obvious. And like, you know, you're 10,000 people in the audience go listen to that, but like, well, that's obvious. Like money doesn't make people happy. Like money solves money problems. But most people understand that intellectually, but don't internalize that emotionally until they get to that point. The reasons that we're driven as entrepreneurs, and we're driven for different reasons, right? But like for me, it was really important to have security, right? Like, I was not poor growing up. Like we were middle class. Like we didn't have all the extra stuff. It turns out all the extra stuff doesn't matter, right? It turns out that stuff didn't make me happy. And a lot of people go through that. And one really interesting phenomenon I saw in the book is that for a lot of people, the higher the number, the harder it was to learn that lesson. It was for this reason. So if you're like, I'm a car guy, right? So think about for us car guys, like you sell your business, you're like, well, I'm going to buy myself a BMW M3. Okay. So you go buy your BMW M3, you drive around for 6 months. Like, well, that didn't really make me happy. Like I needed to buy a Porsche 911. So you go buy a Porsche 911, that doesn't make you happy. And like, wait a second. Like I need to buy a, you know, a Lamborghini or whatever, Ferrari or whatever. And you get that. And then that doesn't make you happy. Like, holy shit, like fancy cars don't make me happy. Whereas, you know, the people that had a more modest exit, right? Like they're like, they get their M3, like, well, this is it. It doesn't make me happy. Like now I have to stop, right? So I think learning those lessons and understanding that things that you buy generally don't make people happy in a sustainable way is kind of obvious, but also needs to be deeply felt. So that's one. I mean, we could talk about investments too, but that's one aspect of it.
Yeah. So what I'm hearing you say is the secret to happiness after an exit is one, take time to let the process unfold before jumping into something else. Number two, we refer to them as pull factors. I think you refer to them as things you want to go to, but effectively have a life scripted that you want to lead after your exit more than golf, something that you're excited and passionate about. Don't go blow it all on fancy cars because it won't make you happy.
You can try it. It just won't work.
Yeah. Are there any other sort of secrets to, did you learn anything about people who had their surname in the business? So one of the things that, and this comes down to kind of family businesses, but oftentimes if their family name is in the business, like if it was Rude Test Prep.
Rude Inc. Yeah.
And you no longer control it. You've got the CEO of the other company who's running it day to day, making decisions that maybe you wouldn't do the same way. Like it can be hard for founders to see their name in lights on the side of the truck and know that they don't control it anymore. Did you hear any of that sentiment among the group that you talked to?
You know, I don't think I talked to anyone whose name was in the company, but I talked to a lot of people whose lives were really closely intertwined in their company. So for example, you know, I talked to a guy who ran a fairly large company, and all of his family was in it, and like his neighbors was in it. And he saw, he said to me, you know, at one point I looked out my window, and I live in a cul-de-sac, and more than half of the houses in my cul-de-sac were like employees of my company. And so then he sells it, right? And like, it was really interesting because he went really far out of his way in his sales process to like really guarantee a bunch of stuff for his employees, right? Like, you can only fire this person for cause, and if you do, here's what the severance has to be, et cetera. So I, you know, for some people, I don't know it was their name, but it was like definitely like their reputation and their feeling that they were providing for certain people, and they wanted to protect that.
I found that to be very generational. Like, I do find there's an older generation of entrepreneur, probably now in their late 60s, early 70s, who have this very patriarchal view, like, I've got to protect my employees. I don't see the same from the 30 and 40 something entrepreneurs. Maybe it's a generational thing, but I don't know if you've seen anything around that. But.
From my own experience, that was the thing that I thought a lot about it. And whenever you sell a business, like, there's just transition in businesses, right? Like, some people leave, some people go. Like, if you don't sell a business, like, there's still some people leave, some people go.
Sure.
And, you know, I think I thought a lot about that, but ultimately the people that, you know, help entrepreneurs build a business, like your best people, like, they're going to find good jobs. Like, they're probably going to find better jobs than the one that you gave them because you were able to, you know, convince them to work under market, or, you know, you were able to help them build their skills to the next level, and now they can get to the next level of compensation. So, like, I think that we're all worried, like, oh, we're going to sell this business and then, like, our people end up on the street, like, destitute. Like, no, I mean, like, they're going to keep going with their lives, right? You're not actually that important in their lives. They're going to go on to the next thing, and it's probably going to be better.
Well, let's leave it there. The book is called Beyond the Exit. It's not out yet, but I think you can opt in on your website to get a notification when it goes live. Just walk through that.
Yeah. So the website is beyondtheexitbook.com. I've got a newsletter there. I send out periodically stories from the book, updates as to how we're making progress on it. And ultimately, I want to end up sending out at least a story every couple of weeks about an exited entrepreneur, because there turns out to be more of us than I thought. And it's great to connect with those people. Great to hear those stories. Great to see what they're doing now. And then our book is hopefully will come out this fall.
Awesome. So it's Beyond the Exit Book.
Book.com.
Yeah. Drop your email and you'll get updates on the progress. John Root, thanks for doing this.
John, it was a pleasure. Thank you.
And there you have it for today's interview between John Root and John. If you enjoyed today's podcast, then be sure to hit that subscribe button wherever you're listening to today's show. And if you want to help support Built to Sell Radio, I'd encourage you to share this episode out with a friend or colleague. For show notes, including links to everything referenced in today's episode, including some of the technical terms that were used, be sure to visit John's episode page, which you'll be able to find over at builttosell.com. Also, if you know of someone who would be a great fit to be a guest right here on the podcast, I'd encourage you to nominate them. You can head over to builttosell.com/nominate, where they're going to have a chance to nominate yourself or someone else to be a guest right here on the show with John. Special thanks to Dennis Labataglia for handling today's audio engineering, and thank you to our community of certified value builders who help us bring our message to you. Our advisors are experts in helping you build the value of your company. To get in touch with an advisor or learn how to become one yourself, visit valuebuilder.com. I'm Colin Morgan, and I'll talk to you again next week.